explore that then, but be prepared, or I'd like to know something about your criteria for making that. I'm assuming that your assumption is that you've got Alzheimer-related folks that you're dealing with in the Pioneers Home, that justifiably the trust should be picking up some of the cost of doing that, but it's a major departure from the way we've allocated the trust dollars so far, so we'll need to explore that. But also on the beds, you know, as you pointed out, we have a problem with about 10% to 15% underutilization of the facilities generally because of our incapacity to deal with the higher level of care that lots of people need. So we've got lots of beds in Anchorage and Fairbanks and all over the system that are sitting empty, and therefore revenue, in theory, is not coming in either for those beds to help pay for the fixed costs. And I'm wondering, as a policy, whether or not you're thinking about additional assisted living beds, which would require additional staffing. But I mean, at some point, you can't wait until everybody, you need to start dealing with the bed issue, I think, right away. And we haven't been aggressive enough on that issue because of the dollars and cents that it costs to deal with those people, the additional care. Perhaps you'd like to touch on that a bit.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Boyer, again, I tend to look at how the market makes decisions as a way that policy should be made rather than trying to outthink the market. You've been in Pioneer Homes, and you know if you had a choice of a nursing home to go into, that's where you want to go. You don't want to go into a private sector. As much as I love the private sector, if I had a choice, I would rather be in a Pioneer Home nursing bed than in a private sector nursing bed. So in terms of the marketplace, choosing the best service, they choose the Pioneer Home. Now, the other thing in a market decision you do is, how much is this going to cost me? In Mary Conrad or any of the private sector, it's going to cost you $6,000 to $8,000 a month. In the Pioneer Home, the most it will cost is $850 a month. So it's real easy to figure out why we have a long waiting list at the Pioneer Home and we have empty beds in the private sector. And I think that we've got to make that market process work so that you also not only can select the best service, but if you can afford the service, you can be given an opportunity to pay the full amount of the service or up to whatever you can afford. And I think that will cause some people who desperately need nursing care but are not receiving it to go into the private sector and take some of the empty private sector beds and get adequate nursing care, so that the problem we have of people not receiving nursing care can be taken care of just by the state changing its method of how it charges.
Yeah,
the assisted living issue, I agree. There are other variations between nursing care and unassisted residential where we ought to be making strides. And I think those will take care of themselves as well, because more and more people will not choose to go to the Pioneer Home as a residence, because they want to stay at their own home. And we make it easier now. We have a lot of great programs so people can stay in their own home. And retire there, and we have meals programs and senior center programs and so forth, and I think it's preferable. I mean, most people would just as soon stay in their house rather than go into an institution. So I think that we, in general, we have a way to get at all of these things, but it's going to require some fairly big, difficult decisions to get there.
Representative Copeland.
Yes, thank you. Although I have some very strong policy differences, I have to congratulate you on giving so far the clearest overview of the department, who does what are the functions, and also the most rational arguments for the increments and decrements. In fact, you're the only one that's even noticed that the price of postage is going up. Looking at some of the other budgets, you're talking about moving the leases in. Are the other departments going to be putting that in their this year FY92 budget, or is that going to wait a while?
Kevin, you might
Or do we do that in budget here?
No, we'll do it, but I'm not.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Copeland, we're planning on, by budget amendment, transferring out of our base into each department that has leases an allocated share or prorated share of the leasing budget into them. The problem there, as the commissioner touched on in the overview, is that we have funding at about 86% right now, and that's because we were coming into the year looking at about a $2.4 million shortfall. Added to that is an $800,000 reduction we took. That totals to about $3.2 million under funding. And it's just getting to a point now where the commissioner has strong feelings on controlling space utilization by putting it back. And so we would propose doing that in budget amendment by transferring our base out to
What's going to be done with lease purchase, like Spring Creek, which is that going to go into capital, or how are you going to handle that? I mean, all of the lease purchase, because we end up with the building, it really is capital.
Mr. Chairman, that's a good question, and I'm not sure how that is, because I don't think they show up on the.
I would have to get back to you on that, and we certainly could get that information for you.
Representative Barnes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Commissioner, under your budget is, and there has been some discussion of telecommunication services. I have a history of supporting RATNET because I believe that we have an absolute need for a communication system within the rural areas of the state as we do in the urban areas. But I can't for the life of me see, and I know you're new, why we are in the telephone business at the state level, or why we're in the business of purchasing new satellites when they're going to be outmoded in a very near future and we'll have to buy new and expensive equipment to hook those up to the satellites. So I'd like to see you address, not now, yourself to that issue and see if the private sector can do that a lot better than the state.
Mr. Chairman, I also share that same concern, and I think there are areas that we will investigate regarding privatizing many of these functions. One of the things that we're going to do is, and we're in the process of doing now, is coming up with how much it actually costs the state to mount some of these services, and as a starting point to see if the private sector can provide the same service at less cost, then clearly we should privatize that function.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Larson, then Representative Brown, and then on to the next department.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'll try to be brief. The answer to the lease purchasing, that's in the front section of the budget to cover those facilities. On the longevity bonus, just a couple of general questions, Commissioner. The raising the age to 67 and the reduction of the bonus by 1250, will that cover the total anticipated funding for fiscal year 92? And by that, I mean the underfunding for the year we're now in, plus the increase the number of recipients next year?
Mr. Chairman, it won't, Representative Larson, it won't cover all of the underfunding, although I think we don't believe that the underfunding, by the time we get to the end of this year, is going to be as great as it was thought when it was underfunded last year. The change that we're proposing, which is, as you know, requires a change in the law to change the letter 65 to 67 and change the date or the amount from 250 to 237.50, will reduce the cost a net of $500,000 below what the currently underfunded level is.
Just going on with that, on the current underfunding for the 12th year, is the administration going to support a supplemental or present a supplemental for payment for fiscal 59, the 12th year?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Larson, we do in fact have a supplemental in for our original estimate was $5 million back in November, and it'll be revised as the session rolls on.
Okay, then question that seniors oftentimes ask, if we increase the age to 67, how do you plan on implementing that? Those who are 65 and 66 who are presently receiving, will they continue to be grandfathered in?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Larson, we would grandfather in everybody that receives it now and, in effect, postpone a decision for 2 years as to what will take place then. In other words, obviously, most of the people who come into the system now are 64-year-olds who move up and become 65. That's, I think we estimated about 2,500 people would come into the system that way. And by just moving it to 67, there are many fewer people, but the 64-year-olds will eventually become 67 years old. So we're essentially postponing it for 2 years.
Try to be a little faster here. How about the administration's policy towards increasing the length of time for, say, longevity bonus recipients to be out of state from 90 days, I see, to 165 to 180. I just bring that up because oftentimes that's a way to save money, not to cost money, because if you're outside, they're not getting it. But one more important question that I thought of in relation to the Pioneer Homes going to be full-time, almost nursing facilities. It's my understanding that we do lose a lot of federal aid because of the 15-year residency requirement. Have you folks discussed that at all?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Larson, I got a good lesson on all these things because I didn't understand why the 15-year limit and what it means. The benefit is that we can't receive any Medicaid support. In fact, the constitutionality of the 15-year is something that we hold our breath on, because if that's challenged, I'm not sure that would survive either. If we went back to the one-year residency, we would then qualify for Medicaid. There's a great concern that we would then acknowledge that these are welfare programs, and that's the biggest argument that I've heard regarding going back to the one-year requirement. The other is, and I don't know the details, but the implications of becoming Medicaid eligible would increase the budget in health and social services by many millions of dollars as we start picking up, or as we're required to pick up some of those costs. So one of the things that has to happen is we have to go to this full cost of care acknowledgement before we can even make a decision on going to whether we're going to go to a Medicaid system.
Just yes or no, it's my understanding that the Medicaid assistance would be an amount of about $32,000 per year per resident. Is that?
I don't know that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Brown?
I'll pass, Mr. Chair.
Okay, Representative Allman.
Thank you. Just very, very briefly, I just wanted to express my concern about a couple of things. The Foster Care Review Board legislation, which now Senator Collins had passed last year, was adopted after a very lengthy analysis of what was wrong with the system and what could make it better. When the legislature passes and then funds a program, it is not the administration's prerogative to choose not to implement the law. And I would just like to express in strongest terms possible that I think we're headed for something of a confrontation on that point. We'll see, I guess, if you introduce the legislation to repeal it, we'll see if the legislature agrees. But I'd just like to point out that admittedly, you're a new administration, you have new ideas, but it is the legislature's prerogative to decide how it feels it should solve the problems. And if it's not vetoed, as it was not, and if the funding is there, the administration has to implement the law. Second point is with regard to the Alaska Public Broadcasting Commission, I think that the cuts are beyond what can be tolerated and still maintain an effective communication system in Alaska. Representative Barnes was talking about the importance in rural Alaska for communications, particularly the radio component of the APBC is an essential link, and we've had a lot of analysis of this over the years because many administrations have proposed the reductions. And it's not just because it's popular with people, it's because it serves a very important function in this state. and particularly given that we know that a cut of this dimension would mean that a number of radio stations would be off the air because they wouldn't be able to meet the match required for federal dollars, suggests that I think we have a real serious problem here. We ought to take a look at that one again, I think. The lease reductions, as I understand it, you're actually requiring, will require the operating agencies to eat the reduction in the leases between the amount which would be required for them to pay the leases and the amount that you wish to fund them at. I think that's really hard to take given how many other things that the agencies are being required to eat. The COLA increases, the retirement benefit increases, the travel reductions, the other reductions, particularly for those agencies that have leases. Some agencies don't have any leases. Some are in public space. So that's going to hit different agencies at different levels, and I think that's a real serious problem if you're going to be short funding it. I would urge you to consider, if you're going to make this change as a matter of policy, that you make the change in the first year without short funding it and see what the fallout is, because otherwise I think you may have unintended service reductions and reductions in programs that you don't even know where those cuts are going to impact. Particularly in the first year, I think that's imprudent. And finally, with regard to the personnel and finance reductions, having worked this budget for a few years, I realize how skinny the portion of DOA budget is that actually relates to serving the other agencies. I think your pie chart is an excellent illustration of it. The DOA funding history by fiscal year, I would suggest you might want to do that by, again, the breakdown between services to the public versus service the core functions of DOA. I suggest if you transferred this information, that is the large percentage of your budget, which isn't the Department of Administration in its true sense of the word, and did an annualized analysis, you would see that the portion of the Department of Administration that makes government run more efficiently has been really shrunk to an unconscionable level. And I think if you further reduce personnel and finance, you're going to find inefficiencies both in terms of other how other agencies operate, but also just in paying your bills to the private sector, service providers, grantees, municipalities, not to mention state employees, and you're going to end up with some lawsuits about not timely filing of those checks. So thank you. Sorry it took so long.
Quite all right. I just have one final comment with regard to public broadcasting cuts. I remember from Governor Hickel's speech that anybody who messes with Sesame Street is in big trouble. Sesame Street is covered, carried on public broadcasting. So.
Thank you, Commissioner.
Thank you. Department of Fish and Game.
Chairman, my name is Warren Wiley. I'm Assistant Commissioner of the Department of Fish and Game, or at least I was when I left the building. And I'd like to, I know we're running short on time, and I had spent yesterday preparing a marvelous little paper that I was going to read a portion of. You should receive a copy of it, along with something probably much more useful that Beverly Rayom, whom I forgot to introduce, the director of the Division of Administration, also provided to you. I would like to read a couple of pieces of this, but let me first, following your the overview format, let me dispose of a couple of portions of that or a couple of questions immediately. To the best of my knowledge, there are no reorganizations contemplated, at least that I'm aware of. To the best of my knowledge, there will be no legislation required to implement any of the changes, the five increments and the decrements to the department's budget. So two of those, the items you have identified in your overview, we can dispense with that quickly. Beverly has a document that you should be receiving that provides marvelous detail for all of this by division. I will also pass around in a moment, we will have passed around an increment decrement sheet. There are five increments and a number of decrements. But I would like to read just a portion of what is really a program review or a summary of the department's contributions to the state over the past year. And while I know you're inundated with paper and everyone has marvelous reports they'd like to hand around, I would like to have asked it when you get a moment to try to flip through this report. It's 13 pages long, but there are some facts in here, some figures in here that I think you'd like to be aware of. The people of Alaska own the most diverse and abundant fish and wildlife of any state, and these are renewable, sustainable assets. A variety of uses make these state-owned assets fundamental to the economy of the state, and the economic importance of these resources becomes more apparent every year. While projections indicate revenues from known petroleum reserves will decline, returns from the state's investment in commercial fisheries, recreational fishing, hunting and guiding, wildlife viewing, and subsistence harvests are healthy and in some cases are increasing. Tourism, much of it generated by interest in these same resources, increases every year. In 1990, the Department of Fish and Game continued its role as a resource agency managing wealth-producing fish and wildlife. Now, important as the revenues are that are and employment opportunities generated may be from the resources we manage, there are other equally important dividends that are realized by the residents and non-residents. Those are the increased opportunities for wildlife viewing and recreational fishing and hunting. Wild natural areas have been set aside as special areas, critical habitat areas, and refuges. Thus, the management programs of the department produce a variety of benefits for multiple users. So the department continues to be a wealth creator. How does it do it? In a variety of ways. The department is involved to a greater or lesser degree in the management or oversight of fish and game resources that generated more than $2 billion last year. Those revenues came from recreational fishing and hunting, commercial salmon, shad, bottom fisheries, non-consumptive uses, and total value of subsistence harvests. All of those resources are, with a proper investment and wise management, a true permanent fund from which Alaskans can continue to benefit. Alaska's seafood industry is number one in the nation. Based on 1989 values, six of the top 10 U.S. fishing ports are in Alaska. It is generally agreed the commercial fisheries rank as Alaska's number one generator of jobs, as the state's number two producer of wealth, second only to the oil industry. It's anticipated that when all figures are in for the 1990 total value of Alaska's fisheries harvests, that number will exceed the prior year's $1.4 billion. The ex-vessel value of the salmon harvest alone will exceed $538 million. That's up more than $30 million from the previous year. The shellfish harvest should be $251 million. That's up from a 1989 value of $245 million. Direct income to the state in the form of taxes for 1989 include $26.7 million in the fisheries business tax, $9.6 million in fisheries enhancement tax, $6.7 million in motor fuel and marine taxes. Now, since about half of the fisheries business tax is distributed to boroughs and cities, that means some $15.6 million goes directly into municipal projects. So the question to be asked, are Alaskans getting their money's worth from that investment in research and management? Well, the ex-vessel value of the salmon harvest alone is 10 times the total budget for the department. The entire general fund for the budget for the department is less than 2% of the state's total. And it goes on. There are just a couple of more things I would like to mention that are included in here. What I'm trying to show is the economic return to the state from the Department of Fish and Game. I guess I probably made that evident by now. But there are others that we may not think of. In 1990, 950 licensed vendors sold more than 350,000 hunting and fishing licenses and tags. Sales of non-resident hunting and fishing licenses increased again last year, with total income to the state of more than $12 million before commissions are paid, I point out. Recreational fishing generated somewhere in excess of $200 million, the equivalent of 3,000 jobs, about $60 million in wages. In South Central, recreational fishermen spent more than $127 million. In the Juneau area alone, there's somewhere in excess by this year, I'm sure, of more than $15 million. Spent on recreational fishing. A couple of others from the FRED division. an economic impact model developed by the Institute for Social and Economic Research Projects. Joe Alaskans should receive $102 million in personal income from commercial fish harvest that will result from 1990 egg takes. More than 3,000 jobs will result. In 1990, the first sockeye salmon returns from a lake fertilization project conducted by the Fred Division produced the best commercial sockeye fishery on the Carluck system on Kodiak since 1926. Last year, the recreational harvest of Chinook salmon from the Kseloff River exceeded that of both the combined early and late runs of Chinook salmon to the Kenai River. Now, there are other returns that are probably not so easily quantifiable from other divisions. All of them play key roles. The Habitat Division, while it does not directly generate income to the state, it certainly plays a key role. In performing its assignment, it works closely with all users to carefully evaluate proposed developments. Last year, for instance, the Habitat Division received 1,183 applications for permits under authorities that are granted the division and the department by statute. Of the total, 338 of them were found to be unnecessary. 834 were approved and 11 were denied. On average, it took the division 18 days to complete a permit review. The Division of Boards you will find mentioned in our budget, both supplemental and otherwise, because of the impacts of subsistence. The same with the Subsistence Division. The federal government, which has already reduced the amount of money to the department for the Subsistence Division and the Boards Division, has told us in more recent months that not only will that money be reduced, but it may be eliminated altogether. We also, the Division of Administration, that division has assumed responsibility for the Fish and Game Licensing Program, which I mentioned earlier. They deal with more than 900 vendors around the state. I think I'll quit now. There is more here, and I would like to have people read through it when they get a chance. But you probably are more interested right now in some of the budget detail. And as I say, Mrs. Realm has provided an excellent document, which I think goes division by division to show you that. We also have a handout here that I don't know if it has a title on it, but my notes is to hand it out after I finish the review, and this has been done. Handwritten by myself.
Thank you, Mr. Wiley. I just will comment that I think you've got some advocates here on this mm-hmm. finance committee and in the legislature, and I suggest that you take this and some of those arguments up to the governor's office and share it with him. That might help if we do add things into the budget, which you seem to be arguing in favor of, that they're not then removed by our governor, given his bent towards reducing budgets, regardless of whether they generate revenues to the state.
Mr. Chairman, I appreciate your comment. The budget that I brought today is the governor's budget. You'll find there are five increments in this budget. The people in the department received the instructions, as did every other agency, and they took a long, hard, serious look at ways to reduce programs, at ways to shift emphasis on ways to get more bang for the buck, and we made the cuts that we were directed to make, and we think that given a sufficient amount of money, we can continue to operate the programs that exist, maybe some of them in a slightly different fashion. My main point was to, I guess, reemphasize the fact that the Department of Fish and Game is a revenue and a wealth generator for the state. It is not a group of folks out frolicking in the streams and chasing ptarmigan off bushes. We make money.
Barnes and then Copeland.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Wiley, in the governor's proposal, which of course calls for a 2% increase in personal services vacancies in the amount of $146,800,000 and a reduction in travel for sports fisheries of $28,100,000 for a total of $174,900. I would like to know if you could tell me how much of these are general fund dollars and how much of this reduction is a reduction in federal receipts, i.e. the Dingell-Johnson funds.
Representative Barnes. I will let Mrs. Rayom answer that in detail, but if the division, I missed part of your question, but if you were referring to the Sport Fisheries Division, that is all Dingell Johnson money.
Were Dingell Johnson's money. Well,
if I could explain just a second. In Sport Fish, it's a combination of Dingell Johnson funding and Fish and Game funding. In other words, the reduction, the 2% increase in vacancy and the 10% travel was an across-the-board reduction regardless of funding source. So we do have a number of cases where both federal funds and Fish and Game funds were affected.
Mr. Chairman, if I may, that leads to my second question, and she's answered both of them, and it's the dumbest thing I have ever heard of. Because, in fact, they have reduced the amount of money coming from Dingell Johnson funds that are federal dollars. Why in the world would you reduce funds coming from the federal government in the form of Dingell Johnson funds? And then down in wildlife conservation, you have Pittman Robinson funds, and I'm sure you've done exactly the same thing there. And of course, these are all coming straight out of sports fishermen and sports hunters' dollars that they pay for license fees, et cetera, to the federal government. So what you've done makes absolutely no sense to me. It's stupid.
I'll ditto that for the commercial fisheries. Representative Copeland.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Every presentation has been hit with the same question, you know, why introduce federal use of federal funds. But anyway, one of the things in that general line that I'm interested in, since the functions of fish and game take your personnel out over the ocean and to the up the rivers and to the mountains and all that, we would be interested if we could get some indication of how much the 2% cut in personnel and the 10% cut in travel, which is not just it's a 10% cut in the amount of money allowed for travel, and that has been accompanied, as I am quite aware when I buy my ticket down here, and by an increase in the cost of airfare, how much the actual ability of the department to get their personnel out into the field has been affected, would be affected if we were to allow that.
Mr. Copeland, we'll try to. There are figures obviously in here that tell you how much is being cut by division. We could certainly do an analysis of how that would actually impact the number of flights per area, which I believe is what you're looking at. Or if we have, if we can do 10 now, do we do 8 or do we do 7? I can surely ask the division directors to take a run at that, if that would help you.
I think his question centered on the fact that the price of transportation is going up, coupled with a 10% reduction in the travel budget. That's more than a 10% impact.
Yeah, that's correct.
Mr. Chairman, we also have not been able to fully allocate this last round of reductions, the 2% personal services vacancy and the 10% travel. You'll notice on the list of projects, the two-page list of projects that were reduced, in some cases we have not made those allocations yet, and at some later date we'll be able to come back with the projects that will be affected by that, and I think we'll maybe at that point we'll be able to address your question also.
Thank you.
Representative Brown.
Thank you. Mr. Wiley, have you had the opportunity to do any analysis, or do you even have a ballpark feel for what the real effects of these cuts will be on our economy, on employment, on revenues, on wealth generated out of the fishery?
Through the chair, Representative Brown, we have not. Perhaps folks in the divisions have attempted something like that, but as Beverly just mentioned, we still have $1.5 million, or so. We have some cuts that we haven't even been able to figure out where we're going to take those yet.
Do you believe there will be adverse economic impact overall from these cuts?
It would be an opinion that I would not have any way to demonstrate yes or no on it. Now, my opinion would be yes.
If you are able to quantify that, I'd be most interested.
We can certainly make an attempt at it.
Any other questions?
Thank you. last year we created the new $10 fee for the Chitna dipnet fishery. Is that going to be fully implemented this this next season?
Yes, that will be. We have been working out the mechanics, and it does bring up some interesting problems that I don't think any of us really thought about, and that is what happens when 5,000 fishermen appear for the weekend with their $10 cash, and we have some person sitting out there with all this cash, and we've had a little problem trying to figure out just how to logistically handle some of that, but our plans are to implement it.
Yes,
I keep saying just hire a couple of guards.
Mr. Chairman, could I? I forgot to mention the Commercial Fisheries Entry Commission. So when you have dispensed with us, would you allow Mr. Smith a couple of moments to talk about the Entry Commission?
I have it sitting right here in front of me.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions? If not, thank you. And Representative Ulmer is the chair of the subcommittee, and I'm sure they'll be in contact to discuss further.
If I could, there may be some changes to some of their documents, because there may be some changes within the department yet, and I mean, I guess there will be some changes.
Yes,
I think so. Some of these will will probably change.
Thank you
for your time. It's nice to see your faces again. It's
Commissioner Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Phil Smith. I'm a commissioner with the Commercial Fisheries Entry Commission. With me is Roger Colvin, who's the director of the commission's data processing and administrative section. I'd like to thank Assistant Commissioner Wiley for yielding a certain amount of time, and I promise not to take as much time as he took. I commend your attention to the small memorandum, three pages, with three pages of attachments, which we have prepared as a broad overview snapshot of what the commission does, what the effects of the FY92 budget reductions will be. And I'd like to answer a question that Representative Brown raised with Assistant Commissioner Wiley, and that is, you know, can you point out an example of where an agency which has undergone cuts to the point that its service provisions are damaged negatively impacts an overall economy? And I'd like to give an example. Last fall, we received a request from the Commissioner of Fish and Game to consider limiting entry in the Togiak herring spawn on kelp fishery. It's a very local fishery, annually generates something around $300,000 to $350,000. It's not a huge deal unless you live in Togiak or Manicotek. We had the ability to go out there, and within the space of about 3 months, we did in fact limit entry in that fishery, which gave the managers the security that they needed not to close the fishery, because they were extremely concerned about increasing participation. We had a travel budget, we had a research capability, we thought at the time, an ongoing capability to receive and adjudicate applications and all the other things that go with limited entry. So I believe that there is a direct relationship between your agencies having enough wherewithal to do their jobs and the impact on real people's lives and real situations, and the ability of the state to maximize the benefits that its abundant resources provide. Anyway, that's an aside, but that is a concrete example. Back to the handouts. Very simply, I think most of you are familiar with the commission and what we do. On page 2 of the handout is a specific explication of where we have spread the cuts to our budget that we are thus far aware of. And I say thus far aware of because we're not sure about this lease problem, and we're not sure about chargeback on the centralized computer. Those are ominous to the entry commission, I don't know at this point how ominous, because I don't know what we're really talking about. It's particularly ominous. I'd like to start at the bottom of that page, because when we were asked to reduce our budget, we took as much as we thought we could responsibly take from our contractual services line item. We took 19.5%, which, as it states, eliminates training and so forth. But if we also have to come up with contractual services money to pay cash under the chargeback thing for DOA and pay leases, if whatever the department as a whole takes is visited upon us proportionately, which I expect it will be, then that will, in retrospect, turn out to be a foolish reduction. Moving up from there, we also cut our travel budget to the extent that we thought responsible, turned it in, and found out we had another 10% reduction. Overall, that yields a 20% reduction in our total travel budget. Obviously, the impact is whether or not we can get out and hold evidentiary hearings for applicants, whether or not we can get out and hold regulatory hearings for people who want their fisheries limited or who don't want their fishery limited, so that at least we can find out where they might be coming from. Above that is the hardest part, I guess, because this is real people, real positions. A $203,000 reduction in personal services. 83% of the agency's budget is people. That's what we do. I mean, we interact with other people. We do not have a capital budget. We don't have a lot of extensive and a widespread network of things to maintain and roads and stuff. We just do the job as assigned by the legislature in our statute, and that takes people. So when there are formula cuts, we can't avoid harming our personal services. Under this budget, we destroy a hearing officer position, which will have a direct impact on the ability of the commission to bring to closure cases that have been before us for years in some cases, particularly the Wassily applicants who were allowed to submit applications under the settlement of a lawsuit that was originally filed against the state in 1975. We'd also lose a research analyst who is the person who would be doing research on additional fisheries when we receive requests for limitation. Also providing information to the public in the form of the effects of limited entry, permit transfers, and things like that. We lose a analyst programmer in our data processing section. Again, this is a support position. It feeds and supports the activities of the entire rest of the agency. Once more, this may prove to be a very foolish choice if we end up shouldering a greater burden of data processing requirements. In licensing, we thought that the least immediate harm would be achieved by eliminating a seasonal and a part-time position. But that will translate into delays for fishermen who are trying to get their licenses renewed. We annually issue over 30,000 entry permits and interim use permits, about 17,000 vessel licenses, and that activity generates about, this coming fiscal year, we're estimating about $5.5 million to the Treasury. Our request is for about half of that, less than half of that. This will impact the ability to turn around requests for license renewals, vessel licenses, and so forth. In a nutshell, that's what happens to the Limited Entry Commission if these cuts as currently proposed are implemented. If there are additional things on the horizon, then I would request the opportunity to come back.
Are there any questions? Representative Brown.
Thank you. Had you been advised by the administration of the chargeback in data processing and the leasing expense that is now to be carried in your budget? And did you have plans underway to figure out the impact of that, or did you just happen to hear it because you sat through this hearing today?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Brown, the answer is that we have not been formally advised that I'm aware of. We've been following a series of instructions, of course. These latest have not. I heard a rumor about it last week. Most of what the commission receives in the way of instructions are filtered through the department. So as soon as Mrs. Rayum hears about it, she faxes us to our office so that we can work with it. So no, we don't have any kind of instructions. And I couldn't even guess what kind of numbers we might be talking about.
Thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner. Nothing further to come before the committee.
Thank you.